You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Douglas J. Feith. He is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the George W. Bush Defense Department and a man who is currently a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, the author of numerous and very important works on national security in the popular press, and also, of course, his opus, War and Decision, a memoir of his time in the Pentagon around the 9/11 period. And Doug, I couldn't think of anybody better, really, to address a rather, well, salacious piece, shall we say, by Kurt Eichenwald, in the New York Times, and I guess it's a teaser of a book that he's written on the same subject, which suggests that you and other so-called neocons in the Pentagon and in the George W. Bush administration before 9/11 were really blind to the growing evidence that an attack was going to take place at the hands of Al-Qaeda because of your preoccupation with Iraq. And I just wonder what you make of this claim and what your not only personal experience, but your very careful rendering of the events that led up to and followed from the 9/11 attack suggests on the subject.
The article by Kurt Eichenwald in the op-ed article in yesterday's New York Times, it makes the rather sensational charge that neocons at the Pentagon who were obsessed with Saddam were somehow responsible for the 9/11 attack by failing to take warnings of an Al-Qaeda attack seriously. I mean, what Eichenwald is writing here is not new, it's not true, and it's not real journalism. It's just accusatory politics. It's basically an unsupported shot at the, at what he calls the neocons. And he has no evidence to support what he's saying. He cites unnamed intelligence officials, making the assertion. There were lots of warnings about terrorism before 9/11. And in fact, when I was undersecretary, and I didn't become undersecretary until July of 2001, just a few weeks before the 9/11 attack, and in fact after a number of the reports from the CIA that he cites in his article. So I mean, those were reports that I never saw because I wasn't in the government at the time. But there were, when I was undersecretary, every morning I would get, something like, a half an inch, sometimes an inch of paper on various terrorist warnings. I mean, there were, the way the terrorist warnings came, there was a thick package of threat reports. There wasn't much you could do with it because the threat reports tended to say things like, we are hearing chatter among people that we think might be terrorists who are saying that something's going to happen big somewhere at some time. And those reports were taken seriously, but there wasn't a lot of specific operational things that you could do in response to extremely voluminous and extremely vague reports.
They were not, as they say, actionable items. They were general warnings.
They were general warnings, but one thing that we did do, and I recount this in my book, and he doesn't make any reference to this in his article, but some of the first interagency meetings that I attended in August of 2001 were specifically on how we can counter Al-Qaeda and whether we should target Osama bin Laden for attack using drones and the newly developed Hellfire missile technology that was attached to the Predator. And this was actively being discussed in August of 2001. It didn't get resolved before, in early September, we got hit with the 9/11 attack.
Yeah. Kurt Eichenwald, former reporter for the New York Times and, as I say, author of a new book that he's flogging called 500 Days, Secrets and Lies, in the Terror Wars, focuses very closely, of course, on a briefing to the president. We were just talking with General Boykin about President Obama missing about half of his briefings. I remember that, generally speaking, George W. Bush was an assiduous consumer of intelligence. And on August 6, 2001, he was acquainted, we're told, with some of these more precise warnings, more precise, more actionable or relatively actionable warnings. And the argument is that, you all were busy with other things I guess I'd just like to get your take on it. Were you preoccupied with going to war with Saddam Hussein and to the exclusion of everything else?
The answer is no. And there were a number of thoughts about the national security policy agenda at the beginning of the Bush administration. Terrorism was on the list. It was not at the top of the list. And it wasn't until 9/11 occurred that terrorism became the top issue. And it wasn't because there weren't warnings. There were some warnings, but the warnings from the CIA were not enormously emphatic, urgent. I mean, there was an enormous amount of intelligence reporting warning of things that never happened, and so for somebody, I think it's just very naive for somebody to go back into this voluminous amount of reporting, much of which was noise and not signal. I mean, much of it was reporting on things that never happened, and go through this voluminous amount of reporting and pick out one or two items that turns out to have been correct, and then highlighting only those, saying, why didn't everybody see how absolutely clear the warnings were? Well, the warnings weren't clear.
Right. No, it's the classic benefit of hindsight. Douglas J. Feith is our guest. He is a former Undersecretary of Defense, served in the Pentagon on 9/11 and in the incredibly difficult days and months and several years that followed it, and has chronicled what happened. I think the most authoritative depiction of it by far to date in his masterful book, War and Decision. And Doug, let me just, in the remaining 2 minutes we have with you, switch gears a bit, if I may. The president, as we were talking about with General Boykin before you joined us, has apparently signaled to Benjamin Netanyahu that he just doesn't have time to see him when he's in the country for the UN General Assembly meetings. As a former senior national security policymaker, and as a man who has deeply immersed himself in the history of the Middle East and the struggle there, how serious a mistake would you say that is, especially compounding it by saying he does have time to meet with Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt?
I think the president has time to meet with whoever he wants to meet with and can move his calendar around if he chooses to. President Obama came into office apparently with the intention of downgrading the U.S. relationship with Israel. And he has done that because Israel had a particularly close relationship with President Bush. And President Obama wanted to distance himself from President Bush in a lot of ways, including this way. And this actually fits a pattern because President Obama does not like Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's made that clear in previous visits. He did unprecedented things like refusing to be photographed with Prime Minister Netanyahu on an earlier visit. There was a well-reported case where he walked out of a meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu and said, I'm finished. I'm leaving. I'm going having dinner with my family. And he left the Prime Minister to talk with lower-level aides. I mean, these were things that were widely and I think properly understood as purposeful signals, purposeful slights, as a way of showing disapproval of Israeli policy. And so, you know, the refusal to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu now is part of that pattern. I think it's a bit surprising because I think it's likely to be not only harmful to American foreign policy as it's been since the beginning of the administration, but harmful to President Obama politically. But he really has an animus toward the Israeli government and its policy.